540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. Tropical storm Idalia nears the western tip of Cuba and is expected to bring dangerous storm surge and winds to Florida's Gulf Coast. CBS News meteorologist David Parkinson warns.
This is a large storm. Everyone in Florida, you've got about 24 hours before things really go downhill. And that's the key message I can give you tonight, is if you are in the Tampa Bay area by this time tomorrow, it's too late to make your moves. So make all your preparations and make your moves over the next 12 to 24 hours.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis reassures residents.
We have a lot of resources staged to be able to respond to the storm. We've got a couple hundred thousand gallons of fuel in trucks and tankers that we can bring in if there's interruption in fuel. We have 7 urban search and rescue teams that are ready to deploy to impacted areas.
The Tampa airport is closing to commercial flights at midnight. A gunman opens fire on the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill campus, killing a faculty member. CBS's Jeff Begay says the motive is still unclear.
CBS News has confirmed that the suspect taken into custody is from China. Because it's still early in the investigation, we don't know the motive for the attack, but it does not appear to be random.
A federal judge in Atlanta has heard arguments on a request by lawyers for former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows regarding Georgia's 2020 election interference case. CBS's Robert Costa with details.
Trump's former Chief of Staff Mark Meadows appeared in court in Fulton County in an attempt to move his charges from state court to federal court. Meadows was present on a phone call between Trump and Georgia Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger.
Mr. President, everybody is on the line, and just so, this is Mark Meadows, the Chief of Staff.
When the president asked for additional votes to overturn the election, Meadows, who unexpectedly took the stand, testified that he organized the call as a federal official, acting under color of his office.
The judge did not immediately rule on the request. California's top prosecutor sues a Southern California school district to stop enforcement of a policy that requires parental notification when a student wants to be identified or treated as a gender other than their biological sex. KNX's Margaret Carrero.
The policy was recently adopted by the Chino Valley Unified School District's Board of Education. State Attorney General Rob Bonta called it a forced outing policy.
It requires schools to notify parents when a student requests to use a name or pronoun, to use a facility, or to participate in a program that doesn't align with their birth certificate or official records.
He says other school districts with similar policies, though not specifically included, will be impacted by the results of this legal action. Margaret Carrero for CBS News, Los Angeles.
This is CBS News.
When you think of hiring, think of Indeed. Their end-to-end hiring system helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates all in the same place. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Your home for local news, weather, and sports across the airwaves and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
With news on WAUK The Shaw, I'm Stuart J. Waddles. A woman from Cedarburg is accused of embezzling funds from schools that cater to children with autism and disabilities. According to a criminal complaint, 42-year-old Heather Wenthold held leadership and financial roles at a Sonnenberg school branch in Racine. After her dismissal, she allegedly deleted numerous files and disabled the company's email system. It's alleged she misused the funds for personal expenses like purchasing a hot tub, acquiring new appliances, and funding vacations. Vibrant concrete planters have been positioned within freshly painted bike lanes on Milwaukee's east side. The initiative, introduced by the East Side Business Improvement District, seeks to create a more tranquil and secure street environment, with more improvements coming like concrete separation and enhanced intersections. With news on WAUK The Shaw, I'm Stuart J. Waddles.
If I could be you,
and you could be me, for just 1 hour.
If you could find a way
to get inside
each other's mind.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
We've all felt left out. And for some, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Think you'd like working with us at Civic Media? We're having fun and moving fast to preserve hometown radio across Wisconsin. If you have the right skills to join our team, let's talk. Civic Media is a proud equal opportunity employer committed to diversity and inclusion, along with the growth and development of all current and future employees. If you're interested or are part of an organization who wants to know more, go to our website, civicmedia.us, and click on the Careers tab.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here. I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe, and is the best way to protect that legacy.
Protect your legacy. Visit ready.gov/plan for the tools and tips you need to start your emergency preparedness plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. We are your hometown radio, refreshed.
Local air pollution and emissions, and officials say they're cheaper to operate. And finally, in Ecuador, in a historic national referendum, Ecuadorians voted overwhelmingly to ban oil drilling in Yasuni National Park in the Amazon rainforest, one of the most diverse biospheres in the world. It's hailed as a historic example of climate democracy, and it was also a victory for indigenous peoples and conservationists.
I will share that hailing. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, September 14th, the deadline for the UAW with the Big Three. Saying, look, you know, contract or we strike. And what they're asking for. You look at Bloomberg News. Again, you know, Bloomberg, corporate news. The headline was Union Boss. I always love when they do that. Union Boss wants 46% raise, 32-hour work week, and war against Detroit car makers. Yeah, I love how they frame that, but I think it's all wrong. The working people who create this wealth want to share in it. And here to share some thoughts on, you know, is this reasonable? Is this outrageous? Or is it just right on? I've asked Frank Hammer to come talk with us. Frank's a retired UAW GM International Representative, former UAW 909 President and Chairman, and one of our go-to UAW guys. Frank, thanks for taking time for us.
It's great to be with you. Thank you.
So let's unpack this headline first, because, you know, as I'm reading through this, my mind just explodes. Union boss wants 46% raise, 32-hour work week in war against Detroit car makers. Is that fair?
Well, the boss part is unfortunately misplaced. They're the bosses, not the president of the UAW. And in fact, this president of this UAW is the first that's been directly elected by the membership. That doesn't make him a boss, that makes him a leader. And he's been filling the role exceptionally well, and you can tell by how much the corporate media is completely rattled that this brother, Sean Fain, is really speaking what is in the hearts and minds of auto workers across the country. And they're responding. They're really feeling that he's with them. And he's so not a boss that he's made a point of being in touch with rank and file workers at gatherings, on social media, every which way that he can to be connected with the rank and file, and so that the rank and file can feel connected with him. That doesn't make him a boss. It makes him a leader.
Now, one of the things that I said right at the beginning I thought he did absolutely brilliant was this demand for a 46% raise over the next 4 years. And it's not that he just pulled that number out of thin air.
That's what the executive class saw over the last 4 years in raising their compensation. So if it's good enough for them, shouldn't it be good enough for the workers?
So that has a little bit of context. And I think that probably the general public does not know about that context. The context is that the what they call the legacy workers, the tier one workers, have actually had a wage freeze for the past decade. I don't think people know that. Yeah. I don't think that people know that the legacy workers, the tier one, have not had a wage increase all during that time that these executives piled it on and piled it on and piled it on. So right off the bat, really what auto workers are trying to do is catch up with where they were before the bailout in 2009. And I think they've had enough. And never mind the second tier workers and the new hires, the temp workers, who really are in a real big jam because of what they're getting paid is minuscule compared to the cost of living and their life's demands on them.
Yeah.
So I think that it's completely appropriate, and pegging it on the increases of the executives is great for optics and for people to understand this is really tilted way out of whack, and we need to get it right.
But this, for me, Frank, and this is an important moment from the past as well. I mean, there was that old, you know, saying as GM goes, America goes. You know, the CEO to worker pay back in, you know, my grandparents' generation was like 20-1, which meant the workers were doing well, the CEOs were doing well. Let's not you know, pretend that they weren't, but the workers were doing well. And, you know, the auto workers were the gold standard of blue-collar workers in this country. And as you've pointed out, because of these two-tier wage structures, because of concessions, these are not those gold standard jobs. These are just jobs.
Yeah, I think the estimate now is that one of these executives makes 300 or 400 times more than what a rank-and-file worker makes in general, on average. And even in comparison to contemporary companies like Toyota in Japan, they make maybe four to one or maybe even 10 to one, maybe even 20 to one, but not 340 times what a rank and file worker makes. That's an obscenity. And they're not liking the fact that the mirror is being shown in their face. And this is what you look like.
No, and this is what we should be doing now. The other thing that I think is important, and it's been years and years and years, in my view, since a union has advocated for a major shift in labor conditions in this country. The UAW was always a very progressive union, always pushing the bounds of what is possible. So now to see the UAW rise again and say, hey, look, this 40-hour work week we've had for, you know, 80 years, it's time to reconsider this. It's time to maybe start talking about a 32-hour work week since automation's coming on, robotics, since there are going to be less jobs. This is the right conversation at this moment. While I don't think they're going to get it, I think it's the right conversation, and it's the right demand for our time.
So it comes from a number of different places, but I want to point out that when UAW, when the auto workers occupied the factories at GM and Flint in the mid-30s, one of their demands was for the shorter work week. And there was a moment in time when there was serious legislation being considered to reduce the work week to 32 hours a week and for 40 hours pay. So historically, we're in the right place, and it's like long overdue. But as you pointed out, with the degree of automation that has transpired in our factories, never mind what's going to go on now, but even up till this moment, the productivity of an individual worker is multiplied many, many times, and they've not been compensated for that productivity. And now, to make additional jobs in the industry that's aiming to cut jobs, one of the key ways to doing that is to reduce the work week. And I want to mention the other place where this is coming from is the incredible hours that workers are working now. Right now, Stellantis and GM have workers on basically a 90-day lockdown. They've got to be, they're obligated to come in 12 hours a day, 7 days a week for 90 days straight. And workers can't cope with this, and they can't cope with their mental health, with their physical health, with their families. And this is partly where this demand is coming from, is we got to shorten the work week. And as President Fain has talked about, we need to make time for our families. We need to make time for our communities. And the only way to do that is shortening the work week.
Yeah, I mean, well, it comes back to that age-old question. Do you work to live or live to work?
Couldn't be said any better than that.
The other part of this that I think is important, because there are a number of facets to this negotiation, which is making this, you know, contentious, difficult, and I can see where they're going to say this is a war, but it is saying, look, we've got to make up for decades, for a lot of years of concessions. We've got to make up for a lot of years of not moving forward and not organizing new members. And one of the key demands in this, and help me with this, is that as we transition to electric vehicles, I got to think these companies are seeing this as an opportunity to maybe, you know, get rid of the UAW as a whole by moving into the new technology. The union saying, oh, wait a second. We want that to be part of this discussion as well, right?
So, yes. And that's, in fact, that is what the UAW has been demanding. And so let's look at this for a minute. I think framework is the fact that we are faced with a climate crisis. We're seeing that everywhere. And we saw that recently in Maui. We're hearing about a hurricane heading to Florida as we speak. And these have intensified. And the planet is wanting to make the transition away from using fossil fuels. So that's the transition that we're talking about. In the auto industry, very belatedly, is making the transition to electric vehicles. And you're right, they're seizing this moment as an opportunity to reset the relations between the capitalists and the workers. And you can see it with the example of the Ultium new battery plant in Ohio, where the UAW won representation. It was initiated as a non-union plant. They started paying at $16.50 an hour, I believe it was.
Yep.
Which is extraordinary, like minimum wage in a sophisticated auto plant. And they're negotiating now and fighting for making it the same level of pay and wages and conditions as our legacy workers at GM and Chrysler and Stellantis and Ford have enjoyed. So the companies are wanting to use these joint ventures to say, oh, well, we can't put you under the master agreement. We have to have separate agreements. And they're using that as a way of scaling back against what working class people need. And what's really bad about this is that it's interfering with a united effort for a just transition to a renewable economy. We need to have everybody on board, and that includes auto workers, and they ought not feel that their jobs are going to be sacrificed in the process.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Frank Hammer. Frank is a retired UAW GM international representative, former UAW 909 president and chairman. Here's the question that I've been asking a lot, because you hit on something I think is really, really important. You know, as we move to this new technology, as we shift gears and we move in a different direction, as with every technological advancement throughout the history of humanity, it's the working people who take it on the chin. It's, you know, when we went from the buggy whips, you know, to cars or whatever, you know, those people who were making a living making those buggy whips, they got left behind. They got screwed out of being able to move and keep up. This time, I hope it's going to be different. I hope it's going to be better. And to see this kind of bargaining that Sean Fain and the UAW are doing to say, look, we're not going to let that happen, I'm somewhat encouraged that maybe this time it won't be so bad from working people. Do you share that hope? Do you share that fear?
So I'm very, very impressed with the quality of leadership that Sean Fain's brought to the table. And I think that a lot of what he's projecting is aspirational. But I want to be, I'm kind of, you know, I've been around long enough in the labor movement. I've been in the labor movement for over 50 years. And I understand the context, and we've been talking about it. When the bailout went down during the financial crisis, the Wall Street, the crisis generated by Wall Street, they used that reset, they used the bankruptcy for restructuring of the auto industry. And I know there's a lot of auto workers that believe that we made sacrifices, and when the companies were going to be back on their feet, we were going to get back all of what we gave up because that was the deal. It wasn't the deal. It was a restructuring, and it was like out of Naomi Klein's book, Shock Doctrine, that they used the shock of the financial crisis, the companies used it, to shave the UAW and cut what auto workers were reasonably expected to live on. They used it to restructure it, to get rid of COLA, to get rid of raises. So even for a while, they actually forbid the UAW from striking. This was part of the deal. And I think that we have to recognize that the companies were doing a reset, and we are confronted now with a reset of our own. And that's going to be very, 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 very challenging. The companies didn't see that coming. The companies were set in their ways that they were going to get their way post bailout.
So, last question I've got for you: September 14th is the deadline. Is that a hard deadline? Do you think? Is that movable? And do you think the chances on the 15th they're going to be on strike?
So Sean Fain has been, you know, he doesn't mince words. He said it's not a, you know, forget it. He said that is the deadline. There's no give in what he's saying. So do I predict that on the 15th, if we don't have an agreement, which I don't think we will, that people will be out on the street and there will be picketing? I believe so. And I think workers are getting prepared. They're having all kinds of what they're calling practice picket lines. And there's a lot of enthusiasm. There's a lot of energy. And I think it's likely, I don't know if you'll see it at all three, although Sean Fain right now is saying, if nobody comes forward with a deal, we'll be out at all three. So that'll be a major event. We will not have seen that in many years.
Well, we'll see what happens. I hope you'll keep up with us, keep us up to date on what's going on. Hope you'll come back and share more as this continues.
It'd be my pleasure.
Appreciate it. Thanks so much. Frank Hammer, retired UAW GM, international representative. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You'll listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
46% raise the executives got over the last 4 years. You know, and you know, they take that without any concern that someone's going to call them on it. That's the amazing part. So when the media goes nuts and goes, they want 46%,
didn't question the executives lining their pockets. That's the thing that gets me. That's the thing that it's really amazing to me, is that, you know, we allow that to happen. It is what it is. Now, you know, Frank did make an interesting point. You know, when the restructuring happened, never let a good crisis go to waste. Corporate America has done this in industry after industry for years and gotten away with it. Finally, someone has survived long enough to say, no, now we're going to go back and get what we should have had. And as he pointed out, the two-tiered wage structure that they put into place back then, where they have frozen the wages of the people who've been there for decades, so that the lower tier can catch up, should be criminal. And I've bashed two-tier wage systems for a long time. Should have never been allowed to happen. Should have struck over that back then. Let's go to the phones. Got Alice on line one. Alice, how are you?
Totally insane. So, couple of things here. Number one, these executives and CEOs in the corporation are getting outrageous salaries. The CEO, I forget, I think it was Bob Yeager, I'm not going to swear to it, but he back in 2014 for Disney, his compensation package, his salary was $10 billion. Yes, billion with a B, plus all these stocks and everything else, and it came to something like $25 billion, and I'm not even joking on that, and I know that because there was a game that a lot of friends and I played, and it Disney had bought it, and they just
did we lose her? Nope, I think we lost her. No, I mean, you're right, Alice. I mean, these CEOs, they've taken an outrageous amount of money and lined their pockets with it. And for me, the argument being, this is where working people should be angry about it. This is where working people should be all worked up. I don't know about the billion number. I'm gonna have to check into that. But, you know, we've seen huge, huge amounts of money going to these handful of people. Now, the weird part of this is, and this is where having a union, I think, is really important. You go back from the end of World War II to the middle 70s, as productivity rose, wages rose. That idea of a meritocracy was then built. That if you do more work, you get more pay, you know, that kind of thing. Well, middle 70s till today, that productivity keeps going up massively. The money going to working people is a deadline. It actually gone down over the last 40 years. So for me, this is one of those moments. This is an important moment that you've got a couple of labor leaders. I look at O'Brien at the Teamsters. I look at Fain at UAW, who are saying, you know what? We're willing to go on these big strikes. We're willing to shut things down. You've got an administration in the White House saying we support workers' ability to do this. And we are encouraging people to join and form unions. This is a moment. Now, understand, and I go back to my MAGA hat-wearing, Trump-supporting union brothers who are, no, Donald Trump is the... What did he do during his tenure? Nothing. He did nothing for working people. There's a lot of talk, there were photo ops, there was all that garbage. But no actual policy. Mock Joe Biden all you want. His policies are going to make your life better. And, you know, I was thinking about this the other day. When your life is getting better, will you acknowledge it or will you be angry at it? Because the more opportunity we give people to share in the wealth that their labor creates, the better our economy is going to be. And when that happens, we're not talking about what divides us anymore. And that's where I want to get to. Thing that drives me crazy about the left is they're happy to slice and dice themselves into oblivion, and the right is happy to use that to beat everybody over the head with. My union contract doesn't say anything about the person doing the job. Doesn't care if you're white or black or male or female, gay or straight or whatever. It doesn't matter. This is the job. These are the wages. This is the condition. These are the benefits. This is your grievance procedure. This is all of this stuff. And it doesn't matter who you are, the person in that job, you have all of this stuff. It blows my mind that any working person would go, no, I don't want that. It's almost unfathomable when you sit back and you think about it. That no, I would rather be at will and at the whim of someone's anger and firing. Because back to what Darren's email, there is a party in this country, the party of you're fired. The cruelty of that message is something that they have internalized. How does that make sense? If you got an answer, I need to hear it. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. I'll take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1963. That was the day one of the most important stands for justice and equality took place in United States history. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his I Have a Dream speech to 250,000 people in Washington, D.C. But did you know that one of the main organizers for the march was a man by the name of Baird Rustin? Rustin is often left out of the history books because he was gay and because of his earlier communist affiliations. He was born in 1912 and raised in Westchester, Pennsylvania. He was raised in the Quaker tradition, and his commitment to peaceful, nonviolent protest continued into the civil rights movement. Rustin joined the Young Communist League in the 1930s, a time when communist organizers were some of the few people actively speaking out about racial injustice in the United States. After he left the Young Communist League, Rustin spent a brief time as an organizer for a march on Washington, D.C., planned in the 1940s. This movement was led by one A. Philip Randolph. The planned march was aimed at putting pressure on President Franklin Delano Roosevelt to desegregate work at industries with federal wartime manufacturing contracts. When President Roosevelt agreed to issue an order desegregating these jobs, the planned march was called off. But the idea for the march lived on and became a reality during the civil rights movement. Rustin went on to work in the labor movement. He became the founder and first director of the AFL-CIO's A. Philip Randolph Institute, which focuses on tearing down the walls of discrimination in workplaces and within the labor movement. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in 2.
Peggy Lee struck a mournful chord with her hit song, Is That All There Is? It was about the vapidity of life, and I found myself subconsciously singing along last week as I pondered the GOP presidential debate. Of course, these made-for-TV spectacles are more akin to mud wrestling than actual policy debates. Still, I dared hope for some tiny element of civic seriousness. After all, the 8 aspirants were auditioning to be, oh say can you see, the next president of the United States. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, for example, stands out as a textbook example of the vapidity of modern American politics. A rampaging ego with no core democratic principles, no authentic persona, no speaking from the heart, and no possibility of being elected, except that special interest powers have pumped him up with a couple $100 million to be their boy. Indeed, a strategy memo from DeSantis' own funders and consultants surfaced publicly just before last week's debate, confirming his vacuity as a candidate and a person. The detailed memo instructed him to avoid talking about policy solutions, to sledgehammer an opponent, to appear both for and against Trump, and maybe to show a little human emotion by talking about his kids. In short, he needs advisors to tell him how to be himself. DeSantis is hardly the first Who Am I candidate for the White House. Hillary Clinton's managers reintroduced her as the new real Hillary every couple of months in 2016. and Rick Perry's handlers tried to make him look smart by wearing horn-rimmed glasses. This is Jim Hightower saying this lack of authenticity is now the norm, for it allows big money to shape candidates in its image. And that's why today's public policies are overwhelmingly based on what money wants, not on public need and honest principle.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
What fun, Vivek Ramaswamy. I don't know why I like saying that name so much. And look, you know, he's gotten a lot of attention since the debate. He's now come out and said that he's gonna tap Trump as an advisor. If he wins, Trump's gonna be his advisor. I'm sure that's gonna go over really well in Trump's twisted little head. Also, Vivek picked up a coveted endorsement, that of O.J. Simpson. O.J. has endorsed the Vivek Ramaswamy and Nikki Haley ticket. I didn't know they were a ticket yet, but that's it. So I know that's an endorsement every candidate, I'm sure wants. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day. Maybe get a thought on the endorsement. I've asked our good friend, former Ohio congressman and political analyst Bob Ney to come share some thoughts. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Good evening, Rick. How are you?
I'm good. So what do you think of the OJ endorsement? Do you think he's got a point? Has he got something here? Well, the Ramaswamy Haley ticket?
Well, I'm just going to bite my tongue. My mind is going 1,000 different directions. So I'll just stay to analyzing the OJ endorsement itself. It gives Vivek Ramaswamy the felon vote.
Yeah. I was going to ask you, when you were running, would you have accepted that endorsement?
OJ?
Yeah.
No. I would have said thank you, but I'll run my own campaign, thank you. You know, it's like when these individual people used to run ads and I turn my TV on and see some ad that I didn't approve and it's on, so I would call and scream the next morning, take that thing off, you know.
Yeah.
Don't do me any favors. Maybe OJ, now this might be Machiavellian, maybe OJ is actually working for Biden, so he endorses Vivek. What do you think? Machiavellian.
Yeah, palace intrigue. You think Biden's got that kind of time?
No. You know, people will believe that.
That's why my mind is now going, you know, they thought he learned coding during the pandemic and then hacked into all the computers. I got people telling me crazy stuff. So this, not the craziest thing I've heard today.
Okay.
Which is, I think,
saying
something.
You've heard a lot of crazy stuff then today.
Wow. Also on the Ramaswamy front, Eminem, mm-hmm. the rapper, has sent him a cease and desist letter to stop using his music. You see this every once in a while. Politicians use, people's music, and sometimes wrongly. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the famous one being Reagan using Born in the USA without actually understanding what the song's about. Does this matter?
Well, no. I mean, Trump, the Rolling Stones asked Trump not to use their music, I think. And then people have asked on the Democratic side not to use their music, you know, et cetera. That's there. Now, I would say if somebody was, I don't know, super, super prominent and went on and on about it, then maybe stop using the music. Now, Vivek Ramaswamy, I don't know if you know this, he used to do Eminem cover.
No.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Yes. Okay.
He did, like he was in contests and things. He did Eminem cover. He did rap cover. And in Iowa, did you see him rap in Iowa?
I did. I'm not a rap fan, so I turned it off quickly.
Yeah. But he rapped because he went to Harvard and Yale, and in college, he was, I can't remember, I read through the whole thing of these candidates. He was some type of cover rapper. Huh. I mean, he did this. This was like a hobby. So he was an Eminem, you know, guy, and that's why he did 8 Mile at the fair when the music came on. Yeah, he was an Eminem rap cover guy. So,
all right, good for him. You know.
Rap boat, maybe.
My problem with Ramaswamy is, you know, miles long. But, you know, I guess, you know, here, you know, recently he said that he would have handled January 6th differently. That he said he would have certified the 2020 elections, though in a different capacity than Vice President Mike Pence. What exactly does that mean, in a different capacity? Is there potentially a different capacity?
No.
Okay.
The vice president accepts, you know, I stood in front of Cheney. Cheney was in the speaker's chair. I was down at the front podium there where the president normally speaks, you know, his State of the Union speech. We had John Larson and I think seven other members. We constituted the Electoral College Board, and we would stand up and call Ohio, Pennsylvania. They stand up now individually. You know, one member had protested the Ohio vote in 2004, and we had a vote, but somebody calls the vote. And that somebody is, you know, the official vote sent from the state. So Cheney at that time couldn't have done anything, and neither could I have, or the other members with me on the commission could have done anything except to accept the vote. Now, if when the protest vote was called, had that in fact passed, okay, that's a different story. Then you have that vote questioned and those electoral votes questioned, then you go back through a process.
Right.
But you can't do it. Cheney couldn't do it. I couldn't do it. No member, House, Senate, Republican, Democrat, could do it. It would have to be done by a member's motion. That's how you do it.
Right.
Now, what it has to pass. And you have to have a senator.
What I find interesting about Ranswamy is, you know, he's on this voting kick. You know, he wants, and look, I'm not entirely against the idea of paper ballots and a voting holiday. I think those are not bad ideas. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he's on this kick. Plus, he I don't know if you saw his idea of a citizenship for people under 25 to be able to vote. And I'm thinking, you know, Alabama in the 1940s or 1950s and 60s.
That proposal is just so non-starter that I don't even know where to go with it. Now, I don't know if you saw or not, he has never voted in an Ohio primary. He is an undeclared voter in a primary.
Okay.
So he has voted in, I think, three general elections, did not vote in the, I think, I'm not even going to quote because I'll mess this up. He didn't vote in a couple of the presidential elections, okay?
Right.
But he has never, as Ohio system runs, you come primary time, you get a ballot for the Republican or you get a ballot for the Democratic Party, or if there's an independent, but if you do not ask for a ballot of either party, you are technically, if you've never done that, then you are technically not of that political party. Now, that doesn't stop him from running, but if you look that up, he technically has not declared. He's an undeclared candidate in the Republican side.
Yeah, I just find it interesting that, you know, he's got all of these questions and, you know, he's throwing out all of this, you know, stuff that has some real historic significance, and he doesn't vote the primary. But hey, that's okay, because you had this the Shaker Heights lawyer. I don't know if you saw this story. He voted twice in two elections, in 14 and 16. So he was just making up for Vivek. That should have been his defense. It wasn't that I voted twice. I was voting for my buddy.
I think he voted from another state, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, Florida or something. Right.
No, but it's one of those things where it's interesting. The very people who are saying, oh, there's all this voter fraud out there, seem to kind of maybe possibly be the ones that are, oh, I don't know, doing it. Just kind of throwing that out there. But what do you think of the idea of a citizen, a test to be able to vote? Because I got to tell you, you know, on an intellectual level, there are a number of people who say things that make me go, I don't know that you should be voting. You know, I know our system doesn't allow for that, but, you know, kind of, you know, it's just a mental exercise. Would we get better informed voters? Would we, if you had to actually know something?
No, because it's just a simple right to vote, no matter who you are, or, you know, whether you've got an IQ of, you know, 120 or an IQ of, you know, 90 or whatever you are, or, you know, your background, et cetera, got the right to vote. That's like, now, we do pick and choose in certain cases, a felon voting. Ohio, once you get out of the halfway house, you can vote in Ohio. In Florida, my former chief of staff, Neil Volz, along with Desmond Mead, launched that whole initiative, as you know, a couple years ago, and they won at the ballot for felons to vote. And then the legislature said, well, you have to pay your fines to vote. Now, that would be comparable to saying you don't vote until your credit card bills are paid.
Yeah.
Or you're defaulting on your house, so you're not going to vote. You know, so I just think it's a broad brush that you vote. And you just can't start the citizenship test. This can't happen. I don't know. That proposal of his is just, that cannot gain ground with anybody.
It's wacko. I mean, because he's a wacko. I mean, he got attention because he was the, you know, I believe in any relationship, it's the one who cares the least who has the most power. And the one who's willing to say the craziest stuff, they're the ones who get remembered. And I think that's what happened during the debate. You know, you think about all of these reality TV shows. Who do you remember? You remember the person who was the train wreck. You don't remember the person who was a decent person. You remember the a-hole.
Well, Nikki Haley and Ramaswamy won that debate. DeSantis reminds me of Jeb Bush. He just looks like he's in agony to be there, you know. The best visual on DeSantis during that debate was when they said, would you pardon Trump? Immediately, Ramaswamy and Haley's hands went up. I can't remember who the third one was. Maybe Burgum. I can't remember. But if you look back at that clip, DeSantis is kind of real quick looking left and right, and then he puts his hand up. He was number four. And I'm like, you know, take a stand.
Yeah.
You know where you're at. You wait till everybody else. But he, you know, he didn't make the big killer hit comments that Haley and Ramaswamy did.
Yeah, no, that's where my point is.
So they took it.
Yeah. Now, I'm not advocating for a citizen's tap. I'm not advocating for this at all. I'm just asking a simple question based on what this guy wants, because I think it's interesting. I think it's an interesting, you know, bit of you know, mental exercise, because I know a lot of people that, you know, I mean, look at Georgia. I mean, you know, the idea that you can challenge unlimited numbers of voters at any time you want is quite remarkable. You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Bob Ney, former Ohio congressman and political analyst, sharing some thoughts on the top stories of the day. Got to get your thoughts on this potential impeachment that's coming up. There's evidently, I'm told, there's a strategy that's being put forth by McCarthy and some of the top Republicans on how they're going to move forward on the impeachment. Not sure what they're going to impeach him for yet, but that doesn't matter.
Well, first of all, there's nothing at this point in time. They couldn't hold an actual vote to, you know, impeach the president. I think that McCarthy has done this to hold his caucus together. Not all of them. There's a lot of moderates on the Republican side and in critical districts that don't want this to happen at all. They don't want it, you know, brought up. By the Republicans' own statements, investigation into the Biden family, you know, they make it sound like the mafia, Biden family corruption. By their own statements, they've yet to uncover anything of evidence of wrongdoing by the president himself.
Right.
So you have to have something that you base these things on. Now, I think that McCarthy's just trying to give some red meat with, you know, some of his people, the Marjorie Taylor Three names and people like that, that want to go back home and say, yes, you know, we're starting the process. It's officially starting.
Oh, and they want to raise money off of it.
Yeah, because what McCarthy says and what he said on the news show on Sunday, he said, if you look at all the information we've been able to gather, it's a natural step forward that you would have that, meaning information, go to an impeachment inquiry.
Right.
And he said a lot of questions remain unanswered. And then he says in order to be able to get those answers, you need an impeachment inquiry, is what he said. That is a, you know, tap dance way to basically, you know, say that he's starting the process to inquire, but he's really not committed that it can go at this point in time full force. He's appeasing 20 or 25 members in particular.
Yeah. What I find interesting is the very people who refuse to go after Trump for his tax returns are the very people who are asking not just for Biden's tax returns because they're out there, but all of his credit card and bank statements.
Mm-hmm. Well, right. I mean, Trump never had to turn over anything. If there is something shaky in regard to president's personal finances or something of that nature, then, you know, the Justice Department at some point in time, if it launches a secondary investigation on Hunter Biden, you know, would look into that. If all it takes actually is a letter from Congress to the Justice Department, and if they do open up something on Hunter Biden, they would take a look at it. They do that kind of thing.
And I'm supportive of it. But I just find it ironic that the people who wouldn't, you know, answer those questions for Trump are saying, right. No, now you've got to give us even more invasive information.
Right. And yet Trump didn't, you know, he said when the audit finished, he'd give them. He never gave it to them. Now, the Hunter Biden plea deal turned into a nightmare. No question about that. But that doesn't mean that justice will launch a particular investigation or that they're in the process of it. The plea deal is a separate deal on two other charges, and, you know, with the not paying of income tax and the gun issue.
Lastly, I got to get your thoughts on what's going on down in Georgia and actually in Wisconsin as well. The Republican legislatures are moving. In Wisconsin, there's talk of unseating the Supreme Court justice that just won the election. Not sure why, but they'll dream up a reason. And also in Georgia, they're talking about ousting Fannie Willis, not for cause, just because, of course. How do I pose this as a question? How's this normal?
You know, I read the story the other day, and I did not realize until I dug into it that the General Assembly can clearly, sort of like a Florida thing in a way, the General Assembly can vote and can oust somebody based on, I'm going to call political negligence, okay? That's kind of a broad brush they would use. I highly doubt that will happen. I highly doubt it.
All right, so you're on the record.
I can't imagine.
Doubt it's going to happen.
I can't imagine, yes.
I fear the Republican Party is so lost that it happens.
They might have a vote. They might try to do it. I just can't imagine where, it in the end here, that it passes. It would just throw, you know, gasoline onto this entire thing. And then you have a new prosecutor. You still have a grand jury evidence that prosecutor would look at. So let me just throw this out here for a second. Let's say they do this to Fannie Willis. Let's say. And they appoint another prosecutor who has still sitting grand jury action. Would that prosecutor then come in and null and void the grand jury action?
That's the question, isn't it? Because you would have to assume that whoever they put into that position already been pre-cleared to undo what's been done. So, yeah, I got to think that if they did replace her with somebody else, it would be someone who knows what the marching orders are.
But I can't imagine that they wouldn't have to still go back through the grand jury again to see if there was anything that Fannie Willis did to influence improperly the grand jury. And if she didn't, I don't know how a new prosecutor survives, because somebody could easily file a bar motion for negligence on the part of a new prosecutor. I can't imagine them going down this road. They might try to do a vote that doesn't actually pass because they want to look good in the districts. I can't imagine it would actually come to it, because that would be one of the most chaotic things we've seen in a long time.
Well, I mean,
but it could happen. You know, I can't write these scripts anymore.
I can't either. But Bob, as always, appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Our good friend Bob Ney. Look, it's a brave new world. Who knows what kind of insanity that they will dream up? Who knows how far they'll go? Quick break, right back. Stick around. Listen to the Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1963. That was the day of one of the most iconic stands for justice and equality in United States history. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his I Have a Dream speech to 250,000 people in Washington, D.C. But did you know the official title for that history-making event was the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom? The popular memory of the March on Washington focuses on the fight for freedom, especially the right for Black Americans to access public spaces and the voting booth. But the march organizers also understood that economic justice was a fundamental part of this broader call for freedom. As Dr. King once famously asked, "What good is having the right to sit at a lunch counter if you can't afford to buy a hamburger?" This emphasis on the importance of jobs and economic justice perhaps was most represented by A. Philip Randolph. He was one of the lead organizers of the 1963 March on Washington. Randolph was the president of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, the nation's first national African-American union. Starting in World War I, Randolph fought for an end to employment discrimination. His efforts in planning the March on Washington were an extension of that earlier work. Organized labor had a mixed response to the march. The AFL-CIO did not endorse the march. Walter Reuther, head of the United Auto Workers, shared the stage in Washington, D.C. with Dr. King and A. Philip Randolph that day. It is important to remember the connection between the call for civil rights and the demand for the right to employment, fair wages, and dignity at the workplace. Labor History in Two brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in Two. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. So I'm going to finish up with the CPAC guy. Interesting that the Sound of Freedom Party, which is, you know, look, I'm looking at this movie, this Sound of Freedom movie, and it's quite remarkable that, you know, my friends on the right are going, "You don't care about child trafficking." Yeah, I do. I completely care about it. I think it's an important issue. And in fact, we've had people on the show to talk about it over the years. We've done all kinds of things to help in those arenas. I find it interesting, though, that the folks who think this movie is the solution, when all it really is just Hollywood doing what Hollywood does. I find it interesting that the party of the Sound of Freedom have nothing to say about Matt Schlapp, which is kind of weird when you're... I'm not going to make the Schlapp joke. I'm not going to make a Schlapp joke when talking about a guy who chases after young men. I'm just not going to do it. But evidently, the CPAC leader's got a history of grabbing guys by the you-know-what. Unlike, you know, Trump, who was, everything was grab her by the you-know-what, Schlapp is grab him by the you-know-what. And nobody on that side seems to care, which is weird. Because, again, there are more allegations coming out, and you're going to find once the floodgates open, he's going to be found to be a serial abuser. You just know how that works. I remember when I was in high school, there was a guy who, he was the cautionary tale my mother used as an example when I was a kid, because she went to the same high school that I ended up going to. And this was a guy who had been, you know, molesting boys for 50 years, and everyone knew about it, and nobody ever did anything until one person came forward, filed charges, and the floodgates opened. And this is my problem with a lot of this stuff. It's there. It's just we're not willing to do anything about it. And look, I'm with some of the people on the right. It's, as a parent, I definitely want to go after it. You lose me, though, when you start going down these paths of,
Well, they're doing child trafficking so that they can do human sacrifice, you know, to drink the blood of, you know, babies or whatever crazy Q-kook nonsense comes out of their mouths. You lost me at that. And then to say that this movie, which is pure capitalism, is something.
You're listening to The Shaw. WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha. And always streaming on the Civic Media app. This